Hey, Andrea.
Yes, Dan.
Hey, Kevin, you there?
I'm here.
I did something interesting. I took a synopsis of Star Wars, and I went to one of those online translation websites, and I took that synopsis, and I translated it from English to French, then from French to Norwegian, from Norwegian to German, from German to Italian, and from Italian back to English. And you know what I got?
The script for Star Crash?
You know, I was sort of expecting it, but it was still a pleasantly reassuring when it happened, you know? So, in any case, that's right. We are going to be talking about the film that makes The Phantom Menace look like Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh!
Star Crash.
I love Lawrence of Arabia.
And we love this film, too. It's Star Crash on this episode of Mighty Movies Temple of Bad. Nothing but Star Crash. Give me that. I think we better stop there before we get into trouble. Although God knows Lucas doesn't need the money now, does he?
Oh, we'll be sued by Disney, which is even worse.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
You don't mess with the mouse.
Yeah, do not fool around. He's a big, mean mouse. In any case, welcome to Mighty Movies Temple of Bad, the podcast that celebrates films so awful they're practically a religious experience. I'm Dan Persons.
I'm Andrea Lipinski.
I'm Kevin Lauderdale.
And remember, all the films that we cover on this show are available over at Netflix Instant View, so you can go and watch the film before you listen to the show, because we've already suffered. Now it's your turn. And this time around, well, this was my choice this time around, and I picked Star Crash. I picked it for really a very simple reason. After the outcome of our review of An American Carol, which was my choice as well, I was sort of licking my wounds after that. So I was a little gun-shy at that point. So I had seen Star Crash over at Lunacon a couple of years ago. We were all on the floor, so I figured it was a safe bet this time. But just so you know, guys, I am holding Baby Geniuses in reserve for some point. So, you know, you are not particularly spared that yet, but this time we're letting you slide. So,
damn it, Dan, that's how Armageddon starts. Stop threatening us with that. And to sum up, I totally disagree with your choice of An American Carol, but I am totally behind Star Crash.
Yeah.
Not the least of the reasons why this film is nutty as a fruitcake.
Yeah, exactly. And as a matter of fact, when we were setting up the show, that was one of the films that was on your list as well, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, it was. So we've got Concord there at least. But people are wondering what the hell this film is. Let's listen to a little bit of the trailer right now.
Split into two warring factions, our own and the one ruled by the evil Count Zarthan from the League of the Dark Worlds.
The Count has created a weapon so vast, so huge, that it would take a whole planet to conceal it. You must sail to the haunted stars. Find the Count's secret planet and destroy it.
And I got to pat myself on the back for at least this. I was watching the film, and they do the credit roll, and the credit comes up at the end, directed by Lewis Coates. And I have been so well trained by Mystery Science Theater 3000, because I think they did this at least once and maybe a few times, that reflexively, when it said directed by Lewis Coates, I automatically thought to myself, otherwise known as Luigi Costello. And then I went to IMDb, and it turned out I was close. It's actually Luigi Cozzi.
Oh.
Is the director of this. So I am at least well schooled in that particular trope. But let me give you a little summary, or let me try to give you a little summary of this film. Stella Starr, played by Carolyn Monroe, and Acton, played by Marjo Gortner, are disturbingly happy-go-lucky space outlaws who are recruited by the space police to battle the notorious space criminal Count Zarth Arn, played by Joe Spinell, who has a giant space weapon that can destroy space planets. Space. I'm going to drop that now. Stella and Acton join forces with blue-skinned police officer Thor, played by Robert Tessier, and his partner El, who's a robot. By the way, that's the way he tends to remind people about it incessantly. And he's voiced by Hamilton Camp, who after this was probably no longer embarrassed to tell people that he had appeared on Turn On. All of them travel to numerous planets to do stuff that I'm still not sure how it advanced the plot. But eventually they pick up a guy named Simon, who's played by none other than David Hasselhoff, the Hulk himself. Yes, indeed. And that makes everything better, of course. And Christopher Plummer is there as the Emperor of Space, because who else is going to be Emperor of Space? So, I got to say this right at the top. Here's what sold me on the film, and it doesn't happen too far into the film. It is, I think, something like the fourth shot, actually, of the film. The film starts out set on a starship. And by the way, handy hint to special effects artists. If you're going to be using actual physical models for your spaceships, do not get in so close to the models that you can actually tell the pieces of the model kits that you've put on the model for detail. You know, that's the first advisory. But in any case, this is like the third or fourth shot of the film. And it's a cylindrical chamber. It looks out into a hallway. And a guy gets into this chamber and pushes a button, and then it appears to move laterally to another corridor, and the guy gets out. So, you know, it's supposed to be like a turbo lift, you know, from Star Trek, you know, where it goes up and down and sideways. Except for this, it's very clear that it's not really moving laterally, but just pivoting around, and it's only pivoting around about of 3 feet to get from one corridor to another. So, you know, basically what we've got here is that on the starships of the future, people are going to be using a mechanical device to turn a corner. It's the Segway aesthetic. You know, why use your feet when you can complicate the process with a mechanism? So,
science.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, at this point, having seen that, that was the point when I went to the movie, I love you. Because if that's how they kick it off, it's all downhill from there. So, you know what, Andrea, this was done in 1978. And this was a period when the Italian film industry was tremendously immersed in doing knockoffs. You know, basically anything that came out of America that was a hit, the Italians would take it and do about 100 knockoffs of it. And apparently, after this period, they all moved to China and started manufacturing handbags. But before that, You know, they did this with The Exorcist. They did this with Jaws. And in this particular case, and it's blatantly obvious that this is supposed to be a Star Wars knockoff. It's sort of bizarre how there's like a beat-by-beat matchup with Star Wars, even though it's the screwiest sort of beat by beat matchup. How did the film work for you, Andrea?
Well, I think part of the time there is a beat by beat mashup with Star Wars, but then there are other films that are thrown into the blender. So, I mean, there are times when it's a beat by beat mashup with Jason and the Argonauts. And I mean, poor Ray Harryhausen, I know he was dead at the time, but you know, my God, it would be like, you know, I know I misspoke. Ray Harryhausen was alive at the time, but I would be thinking that he would be rolling in his grave if he were dead to see, like, oh my God, this is what I did with Jason and the Argonauts, and this is what you morons are doing. But look, any film that starts, you started talking about the credits, and I thought you were going to mention my favorite credit, very beginning, Roger Corman Presents.
Yes, well.
Yeah, that's never a good sign. But I mean, even the very opening shot rips off the opening shots in Star Wars, mm-hmm. with the starfield and then like the close up on the ship coming really close right over by the camera.
Right.
Except in Star Wars, it wasn't blatantly obvious that it was a plastic model. And here you're like, oh yeah, that's a plastic model.
Yeah.
But come on, there's big time science going on. People say things like, scan it with our computer waves.
Yes. I think that's one of the first lines, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, come on, even radar would have sounded better than that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of science stuff. I mean, things were shot through lava lamps.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They got their money's worth from the lava lamps. I'll say that, you know.
Yes.
Kevin, how was your impression of the film? Had you seen this film before?
I had not seen it before.
So I
was tragically misled by the first couple of minutes. Now, let's address a couple of things.
Okay.
First of all, I had a great epiphany. It had been the third time I was watching the opening credits, which are indeed a ripoff of the opening shots of Star Wars. I finally realized what it is that makes a cheap Star Wars ripoff in terms of special effect different from Star Wars. They're both using models. They both have backgrounds. I realized that it's because the models are usually too clean. The spaceships in this film are stark white. They're just the model kits that were bashed together. In Star Wars, the universe is well lived in. There's dirt. There's scratches. There's carbon scoring all over the place. That's the secret that the folks at Industrial Light and Magic learned. In order to make a model not look like a model, make it dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's actually one fairly sophisticated, one unsophisticated science fiction reference in the opening minutes of the film. As that ship goes by, we see the ship is named the Murray Leinster.
Yeah.
Who is that? Well, Murray Leinster was, I happen to know his name right off the top of my head, a very prominent science fiction writer in the 40s and 50s. And in fact, I think it's a novella, First Contact, is one of the first contact stories ever done. And it's also one of the best. I recommend it highly.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of minutes later, I think it's when they're in the turbo lift, you hear the PA system, contact Major Bradbury.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, this is going to be a knowing film. It's going to be filled with, you know, some science fiction references. The people who are doing this know what's going on. Nope. They don't know what they're doing. That was it. Those two references, and then pow.
Yeah, it plummeted downhill after that.
Yeah, I'm still not sure. I'm like you, Dan. I watched this movie three times. I couldn't really tell you what happened. I know there was some action. I know there were some explosions. Is Stella's buddy Acton supposed to be Robin Williams as Mork?
You know, it was bouncing around the back of my head, but until you mentioned it.
The hair and the big triangle on his shirt, and sometimes he stands at parade rest with a smirk. Every time he comes on screen, I expect him to say, "Mork Colin Orson, come in, your immensitude." I was really thrown off by that.
Yeah, there are a few weird things about Acton, but you know, I and we'll get into a few of those, but you know, you Andrea, you brought up the idea of, you know, scan it with the computer waves. I mean, there is dialogue in this, and there are lines. I mean, they modify nouns in the weirdest way possible and the most pointless way possible in this film. There's another line later on where Stella is sneaking onto a ship and somebody says, "Put down that rifle, Ray." And I'm going, "Excuse me? You're letting rifle modify Ray?"
Well, I mean, look, some of the language was, I don't know, so specific. You know, whenever you write something that's said in the future, you think, well, how will people say this in the future? So they won't say, "What in the world is that?" They'll say, "What in the universe is that?" You're like, oh, boy. But then Act then later uses the expression "red hot potatoes." So in the future on spaceships, people still know what red hot potatoes are? There's lots of stuff about, you know, the universe and don't get me started with the language in this movie or the science in this movie, God help me. I don't forget, Christopher Plummer is not the emperor of the universe. Christopher Plummer is the emperor of the first circle of the universe. What is the? Is this like Dante's Inferno? They're like levels? They're levels of hell? How does this work? First circle? What the hell?
And apparently, judging by that, space is also two-dimensional.
Well, you know, in space, things are not really the way that I expected. I didn't realize how you could get by in space with so little clothing. Thank you, Caroline Monroe. Whoa, now we're in a new outfit. Whoa, now we're in another outfit. Oh, my God, now we're in another outfit. Oh, now she's covered up in a translucent outfit over her sexy outfit. And you're like, are you dressed up for an S&M party at the beach? What is this outfit?
I didn't have any problem with that, Kevin.
No. It is interesting that when you just jumping ahead, when she ends up in prison, apparently they let you keep whatever clothes you were wearing when you were captured.
Well, yeah, I was wondering about that prison thong she was wearing.
That's when you go to prison, you wear, you know, either that or they let make you take off a few things. I mean, she was the only one walking around in her little space bikini.
Yeah. Okay, well, let me explain something about the prison scene, because that was one of the first things I zeroed in on. They get captured eventually. They're running from the cops. Thor is one of the cops, and he's supposed to be a robot, except he doesn't really look much like a robot, except he's got this weird sort of coffee pot-like thing for a head.
L
is the robot who talks with a Texas twang for no particular reason.
Thor is the one with the uneven face color. Like in some scenes, okay. You can see his neck is kind of tight. Yeah.
I didn't notice that.
Did they run out of budget on the makeup?
Yeah.
Like, is he supposed to be green all over, or is only his face supposed to be green? Because sometimes he's green all the way down to his neckline, and sometimes they ran out of makeup, and his neck is human flesh color, and then his face is green, and you're like, well, somebody's getting lazy.
I didn't notice that. Now I have to go back and look.
But go watch it a fourth time, Dan.
But okay, but Thor and Elle capture Stella and Acton, and they sentence them to prison. Now, here is and apparently separate prisons for some bizarre reason. Here is prison for Stella. Okay, first off, she is wearing it's basically two straps that come up from her crotch and over her bosoms. And that's about it, okay? And what prison is a catwalk with two stairways curving down it and a hole in the middle, and people climb up one stairway carrying a litter with a giant beach ball on it and dump the beach ball into the hole while somebody is going, "Come on, put that radium into the hole. Move it along. Get that radium into the hole there." And, you know, it's been a long time since high school science. I did not know that radium looked like a giant beach ball. But, you know, apparently that's it, you know, and that's the whole of prison. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, is this sort of a Sisyphean sort of thing?
Keep in mind, she is specifically sentenced to hard labor. That's hard labor. Walking around in the sexy outfit with her hair and her makeup still beautifully preserved. And the fun part is when the guy says, okay, you can have a 5-minute break, and she commiserates with her fellow prisoners. She says, quote, I've been at this for 12 straight hours. The radiation will burn my skin off. I'm like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't be showing so much of it, honey. That's your going around with radiation outfit? She'd be dead in 5 minutes. What is this about? Oh, I've been doing it for 12 straight hours. And meanwhile, she's talking to two other people who, A, shouldn't have any sympathy for her, and B, know how to dress for carrying radium ping pong balls around.
And then she manages to escape from this. She escapes single-handedly because apparently nobody has ever tried that before in this prison.
Punching somebody and grabbing a gun.
Yeah, oh, she has the element of surprise. And no one has ever tried to escape before? They're like, all you have to do is this. Okay, and then boom, like 2 minutes later, boom. We're done. We're good. Oh, and everything's blowing up. Oh, but the people that we want to escape. Of course, they are not all blown to smithereens, as they should be. Why am I bothering questioning the science in this movie?
No, you should not. Let's question something else, though, because when she is escaping, you know, she does take out a few of the guards. You know, they die from explosions or gunshots or whatever. And then as she's escaping from the prison, she gets picked up by this spaceship. And it turns out that it's, once again, Thor and El in the spaceship, only this time they're helping her escape. You know, and let me just make this clear. Members of the police are helping her to escape. The person who just killed a number of police guards.
Yeah, but now the emperor, because the emperor said so.
Right.
Because Christopher Plummer said so. Poor Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, I know.
Was he behind on his rent? What the hell happened?
You know, this is the thing with British actors. You know, their operating philosophy is, you give me the cash, I'll show up and read the shit you want me to read.
Wow.
You know, I will bring it. You know, and so in any case, they're helping her to escape now. And as you say, the emperor has asked them to help her escape because they need her to go on this mission to find Count Zarth Arn, you know, and stop his Death Star dealy.
Can we talk about Zarth Arn?
Yeah, we will get to it. I just want to point out one further thing about this escape.
Yes.
Is that they go, you know, they pick her up and they go, and now we have to get your colleague Acton out of prison too. And I go, okay, well, here's another action sequence, you know, with a prison break. Nope, it's some police guard taking Acton up to the ship and going, okay, here's Acton.
It was like they were keeping him in a closet or something.
Yeah, really.
I don't know what he was doing.
Lenny, do we have any Acton in here?
Huh.
So, Kevin, did I miss anything in the exciting escape sequence here?
Did you miss the reference to the unknown planet named Euragus?
Ah, yes.
It's unknown. I'm glad it's not that unknown. It's got a name. Aren't they being broken out specifically to go find the sun? Of
yes.
The emperor?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the thing, although we don't know that just
okay.
yet.
Okay. Well, we did miss one thing,
yeah.
Which was the golems, the first of the stop motion animation creatures.
Oh, yes, right.
And I was talking about a love song to cheapness. Golems are basically the armatures, when you make a stop motion creature, first you build the skeleton, and then, if you're Ray Harryhausen, you put stuff on top of the skeleton. Mm-hmm. If you're these cheap bastards, you just make the armatures.
Yeah, they couldn't be bothered.
Yeah, you animate those as your. Didn't the space station? Which space station look like? I have no idea. Space station looks like a suitcase. Is that the Penal Colony? I think it is.
I have questions about a lot of the spaceship and space station designs in this picture. There's lots of questions about the makeup design, creature design, spaceship designs. I also have questions for why everything is so damn loud. They're fighting and the guards are shooting lasers. I couldn't handle the laser battle. I felt like I was in the dentist chair getting my teeth drilled.
If you can't do it good, do it loud.
In space, no one can hear you scream. Inside space, you can hear everything.
Or in space, no one can hear you scream because you're being drowned out by all the goddamn gunfire. So, Andrea, you want to talk about acting a little bit?
No, I want to talk about Zarthon.
Oh, Zarthon. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I will also talk about acting, but I came up with a explanation for Zarth Arn, because he is like so over the top. Okay.
You sound right. Fabulous.
Rewind your brain to the last time that you watched the Monty Python skit about the Spanish Inquisition. And then they go, diabolical laughter. And then they go, diabolical acting. It's like that. That is the way that he acts. You're like, oh my God, the outfit, the way that he talks, could I look any more evil, come to me, golems. I mean, very dramatic, very all over the top. By the way, also an extra annoying for the golems. He had the money to make the golems. He didn't have enough money to oil them. They sound like the friggin' Tin Man. And why do they have swords? What's that going to do? But no, I mean, most of the budget was spent on, limited stop motion animation and friggin' lava lamps. But no, I mean, Zarth Arn just cracked me up. Every time he came on the screen, I was like, okay, here we go. This is going to be fun. Acton just annoyed me because I kept going, what's his deal? What's his special power? His special power is using stupid special effects, or is his special power yelling at things?
He says he can see the future, which is useful for a navigator. Oh, we're going to be lost. But it's never really – that's never fleshed out sufficiently for him to do anything about it, except to say, I knew it would be okay.
The question is, who exactly would follow a guy who looks like that? I suspect that it's almost pity following, actually. Let's let him think he's in control.
Now, wait, are we still talking about Zarth Arn or are we talking about Acton? Oh, okay.
No, we're talking about Zarth Arn.
Yeah. I don't know, but Zarth Arn's followers are wearing these ridiculous outfits. So maybe there's some kind of a weird, cult fetish thing. Would they all like wearing pleather or whatever the hell they were wearing? It's ridiculous. If it was just this is what they think the fashions of the future would look like, or if it was just because it was a lot of Italians coming up with the costumes, and they're yes, this is what we will wear in the future.
A lot of this, is the Italian aesthetic. If you've seen any of the Italian science fiction films, that the tendency is with Italian special effects, they are not really all that intent on scientific accuracy. They're more like, let's make it big and colorful and fun and a lot of stuff moving around the screen. But even with that, this goes over the top. It's just, the planets are beach balls. The stars are like these large polka dots.
Christmas lights.
Yeah, Christmas lights. It's just very bad stuff. I want to actually get back to that stop motion animation, though, Kevin, because this was amusing for me. You talk about Ray Harryhausen. And the fact that very clearly this stuff is supposed to ape Ray Harryhausen. But the reason why Ray Harryhausen is considered an artist was that, you know, single-handedly he developed a way of animating stop-motion figures so that they moved with grace and they moved with credibility. He understood, you know, that, you know, if something moves an arm, it's not just the arm that's moving. The body has to shift. There has to be a suggestion, you know, that weight is being adjusted, all of that. You talk about the golems. I mean, one of the ridiculous things about the golems is that they're standing there. When they move the arm, it's just the arm moving. You know, just and it's, well, it's not credible at all. And what the even better example in this film is that a little later on there is this figure which is supposed to be, and it's really clearly knocked off from the Colossus of Rhodes sequence from Jason of the Argonauts. It's supposed to be this giant figure that's moving and trying to get the good guys. The problem is that, as I mentioned, when Ray Harryhausen animated it, he understood where you needed to position all the parts to make it look like it was actually moving under its own steam. When these people do it, the thing raises a leg and the entire torso flips backwards, you know, and it looks like it's about to fall down. It looks like it's defying gravity at any particular point. So, you know, it's basically, it looks like the beginning stages of somebody learning to do stop motion animation and not quite figuring out, oh yeah, this has to reorient to this position when this thing moves.
Right, but that Metal Guardian had nipples. I think in Clash of the Titans, Ray Harryhausen's Medusa has breasts, but no actual nipples. These are the first special effects stop-motion creatures I've seen with nipples. Yeah, back when this film was made, and I was a young lad, I was really interested in special effects. And I had a couple of books and magazines that you could order out of the back of Starlog about how to do your own special effects. And it looks like the people in this multi-million-dollar film had the same books and were sort of teaching themselves the process. That Metal Guardian, yeah, just sort of pivots. And I imagine that it was a pin, a structural pin underneath it somewhere as they slowly moved it. Ray Harryhausen was able to give his characters fluidity and, more importantly, character.
Mm-hmm.
The stiltedness of the stop-motion animation here lacks all character. I would even say that that Colossus Rhodes figure has its own sort of flinty, stiff character to it. This mm-hmm. is clearly people just moving stuff, and they're not even using the Dynamation process where things are very carefully animated and adjusted to match the live action. They just double exposed or matted in, you know, tiny little figures in the bottom running around. It's the worst possible ripoff. It's feh.
While we're talking about special effects here, Andrea, and this is another one of my favorite sequences from this. When they're about to go on this mission, okay, Acton, they're trying to figure out what planet to go to next, and Acton explains to them all the planets that they could possibly be going to. And here's what the sequence is supposed to be, is that Acton holds out his hand, and he describes the planet. There's this planet, and it's got this type of atmosphere and this, and he holds out the other hand, and he says, and then there's this planet, and it's got this atmosphere. And you can figure that the idea is that what they were probably planning to do was to super in a simulated hologram of the planet. So he holds out his hand, and the planet shows up in his hand, and he describes it, you know. Never mind how it just so happens that Acton can generate holograms out of his hand. Let's just go with it for now. It's supposed to be a hologram in his hand. That isn't what they do. What they do instead is put up some sort of oscilloscope or laser-generated squiggle that bounces around over his hand for 5 minutes, and, you know, the people around him are going, yeah, sure, Acton, that's a planet, okay.
I mean, your idea of him holding up his hands and then, like, a hologram of the planet appearing in his hand makes 1,000 times more sense. Because what you actually see is, like, what? You know, oh, and now we're going to be visiting a, you know, Class M planet, and yes, there's air, and yes, you can breathe it. Let me hold out my hand, and here, you know, watch this thing jumping around in my hand, yeah, and you're just staring at it.
I think, like, there was a Pong game at one point going on, but I'm not
right,
sure.
You're like, what is that? What is that shape? What are you doing? And he did that a couple of times, and then later he's goofing off. He's, like, holding up his hands, and he's doing things, and I'm like, what are you doing? What does this mean? I mean, does he, I don't know. I mean, and then how does he use this power? Does he use the power for anything good? Or does he just go around giving people joy buzzer handshakes? I mean.
He works part-time at Laserium. Pink Floyd shows.
Kevin, you know, I get the feeling a lot of this film could be explained by the idea that maybe these are all people who only think they're doing what they're doing. They're actually all under delusions. You know, Acton thinks he's generating planets in his hands. Darth Arn thinks he's actually commanding an army.
That would make a lot more sense than what seems to happen, which is just a series of plot points which don't build to anything. It's like, oh, now we're going to go do this. Okay, great. Well, I suppose one character did get added to our little coterie. That's nice. We had talked earlier, and I have to keep up my reputation here. I'm going to drop Camille Paglia's name here.
Oh, my God.
Okay, I'm leaving the room.
Okay. Because it was actually something real interesting. She just has a new book out about the history of art, and the last entry in it is the entire Star Wars cycle, in which she said something which I had not actually heard verbalized, but which I think explains a lot of the entire Star Wars ripoff phenomenon, which is, she says, people saw Star Wars and they said, ah, this is a huge success. Here is what we need to be a success. And they only took the surface. They said, okay, producers said, great, we need space shots, we need explosions, we need lasers. It's as if they took Star Wars, turned off the volume, and then only took the visuals without any regard to story and just spread those all over the place. Because that's what we have, is we have visual cues ripped off with no regard to story or plot or how things are supposed to develop.
Kevin, you left out the most important visual cue.
Breath.
Lightsabers. Oh. No, yeah. Not breath.
I'm a Carolyn Monroe.
Excuse me.
Yeah, more the words of Chris Rock in Jane and Silent Bob Strike Back. I think George Lucas is going to sue somebody's ass. Saw those lightsabers. I was, whoa.
Well, look.
Well,
for
one thing, it was Acton who was wielding the saber, and it was less Star Wars than it was Spaceballs. You know, I was expecting somebody to say, I see your Schwartz is bigger than my Schwartz.
Go ahead, Andrew. Did you have a more...
Oh, yeah, Andrea.
So. Well, no. I mean, I was just going to say, like, there are lots of things that are, like, visual cues from Star Wars. But every time that you see a movie that was made, like, within, you know, 5 years after Star Wars, where characters happen to whip out a lightsaber at some point, you're like,
It is truly unique. Yes, it is truly unique to that universe.
Thank you. I mean, I'm sorry, the only other, and this is going to be really weird, get ready for this, one of the only other films that I remember seeing where characters happened to whip out a lightsaber was in The Pirates. It's a musical with Christy McNichol.
Oh, yeah.
And at some
based on
point...
Pirates of Penzance.
And it's based on the Pirates of Penzance and loosely Star Wars. And there's this weird scene in the middle of the movie where suddenly there's this big fight scene and suddenly somebody whips out a lightsaber. And you're like, what the hell just happened?
I'd like to throw in another cue from Star Wars that gets picked up here and translated into something really weird. And it's a little bit of an obscure cue from Star Wars, but you know the sequence from the first Star Wars film, aka Episode 4, A New Hope, where they're escaping the Death Star. They get into a dogfight with some TIE fighters, and they blow up the TIE fighters. And the sequence that the filmmakers seemed to latch on was the moment where Leia grabs grabs Chewbacca and gives him a big hug and goes, "We won! Yay!" And for some reason, that got translated into this film to the aftermath of any space battle in this film. Everybody is excessively jaunty about all the lives that they've claimed. Did you notice that? It's like, well, they're all dead now.
Well, I mean, people do seem way happier than they should be about all the carnage. But adding to that problem, or perhaps exponentially multiplying that problem, is how many of these characters were dubbed. And, I mean, a lot of them were dubbed by themselves, as I was reading stuff on IMDb. But some of these characters were dubbed, you know, by other people, because it was an Italian film, and apparently this was something that you did all the time in the 70s, that you just come in afterwards and then re-record. So, like, Caroline Monroe, that's not Caroline Monroe. That's another actress who, by the way, the other actress who dubbed Caroline Monroe was married to Marjo Gortner at the time. So get that out of your head. But so even like her going, "Yay, we did it!" That's not her. That's a dubbed over person afterwards saying, "Yay, we did it." You're like, "Ah, you sound happy."
The other thing about that space battle, or one of these space battles, is that there's like a central space battle where they're escaping, and it is supposed to be the TIE fighter battle from Star Wars. And all I can say is that the people cutting this were not really paying attention to what was going on when they were putting this thing together. There is one point in the film where Stella screams out something like, "Just one more," meaning we've got only one ship to one more ship left to knock out. That's followed by a shot of three spaceships flying towards the ship. And then it cuts back to Thor, who goes, "One down, five to go." And it's like... Excuse me?
There are a couple of things. If you just want a good laugh, look up. Well, if you want a good laugh, watch this movie. But then if you want another good laugh, go on IMDb, look up Star Crash. First off, click on external reviews. And there are so many external reviews. You can spend hours just reading those. Mm-hmm. But if you look under, like, you know, goofs and trivia and continuity problems, they talk about a bunch of stuff like that, including the thing where, you know, somebody says, you know, two ships down, but like there were three ships or whatever, things like that. There was another line by my buddy, Zarth Arn, who says, yada, yada, yada. And by the time the sun has set, I will be in control.
Oh,
and
yes, yes. I forgot
but
about
in
that.
Outer space. If you're in outer space, there is no "the sun has set." Hello? And look, I'm sorry. We're not jumping ahead to the end of the movie yet. But at the end of the movie, during the big battle, there's some major science screw-ups going on that really... add to the nuts in the fruitcake that is this movie. But when are we going to get to the Hoff?
I was just about to bring it up because, we've got to move on now. So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Hoff because he is here. This is definitely pre-Knight Rider, and he's dreamy.
And you have to wait 52 minutes.
Yeah, that's true.
Until you see him. You're spending the whole movie going, "Where's this David Hasselhoff?" And then you're like, "Where is he? Where is he? Where is he?" And then you don't realize that it's him. And then he takes the mask off. And then you see that it is David Hasselhoff. And then certain questions arise. Like, how did his hair stay so poofy under that mask?
And, well, you know what? It's amazing because it's sort of like what they – if you watch Adventure Time – mm-hmm. You know, if you watch one of the main characters, Finn, wears this cap, and when he takes off the cap, it's like this beautiful flowing mane mm-hmm. that bursts out. He takes off that helmet, and the hair goes...
Well, that happens a lot. But characters in this movie have way too beautiful hair.
But it's like Jiffy Pop.
Yeah. No, but, I mean, in addition... Okay, I mean, because I was like, oh my god, Hasselhoff's first close-up reveals a lot of eyeliner. Those are some very shapely eyebrows. And he's also sporting some stylish shoulder pads as well. He's very stylish, this one.
He is wearing enough eyeliner. I think Nestor Almendro saw that this film and went, hmm. For people who know who Nestor Almendro is.
I'm thinking ahead to David Hasselhoff, and I have a note here from my favorite scene. Okay, am I watching David Hasselhoff fight a mechanical golem with a lightsaber, or am I having a fever dream? I mean, there's just some really wacky stuff in this movie.
Yeah, I know.
Let's just briefly sum what happens in between golems and Hasselhoff. Captured by warrior women on a snow planet where the temperature drops thousands of degrees.
yes.
Stella Starr frozen. I know here, don't drop her, she'll shatter. Attacked by leaping cavemen. Uh-huh, Stella Starr captured. Okay, rescued by Hasselhoff. Okay.
And by the way, just to throw in, at least four or five times that Elle says, it's a good thing I'm a robot.
Yeah, just to clarify, in case you forgot from 5 minutes earlier that he was a robot. And by the way, even though the temperature did drop thousands of degrees, she was saved. Her life was preserved because the robot saved her from freezing by holding her hand. And then when she gets thawed out, it is utterly ridiculous. And, of course, her hair looks even more beautiful after she's thawed out.
By the way, when temperature drops thousands of degrees, do the atoms actually not only just stop, but actually reverse movement? Is that what happens?
You might have a point about the science in this movie. Yes. One of many points.
You know, it's sort of like moving past the speed of light. When it gets down to 1,000 degrees, you actually move back in time.
Then maybe that's how her hair got so gorgeous.
At some point during all this, suddenly she's wearing a translucent spacesuit over her still-worn black space bikini. Right. Why was that?
I think they had raincoats left over from the opening sequence of Singing in the Rain.
She was trying to make weight for a fight? I mean, I don't know. So that they could obey the letter of the law but not the spirit? And say, no, she's not in a bikini all the time. Now she's in a bikini with some saran wrap over it.
Yeah. Is that an issue in Italian films?
Well, there was a thing. Here again, this is from IMDb. If you'll notice, she's in very skimpy stuff in the first half of the film, and then she covers up during the second half of the film. And according to IMDb, that's because the producers were concerned about selling this to TV afterwards. So
covers up in see-through clothes.
Yeah, but still covered, nevertheless, underneath. So,
and later the cover-up things do become actually opaque.
You know, it's the Betty Boop progression here. You know, it's like in the beginning she was like, you know, in negligees with garter bands and all of that, and by the end she was in full-length dresses. Same thing here. Again, another obscure reference. So,
not that obscure.
No, that one I got.
Okay. Well,
it was a Saturday morning cartoon show about Babe.
Right.
All right.
So are we saying that Acton is Coco the Clown? Or something
that explains it.
Out from the inkwell.
Oh, man.
So, you know, they get rescued by, what is it, the Emperor?
What is Hasselhoff's character's name? I can't remember the names of half these characters.
What was it? Troy? Simon. Simon it was.
Something waspy.
Yeah, Simon. It was Simon.
Yes.
Prince Simon.
Uh-huh.
Which makes sense, of course.
Who just at first acts like an ordinary guy, and then it's like, whoop, Your Highness. Your Highness? Oh, my God, I had no idea. The hot guy with the eyeliner was the son of the Emperor?
Do you want to talk about Christopher Plummer a little bit? We already did a bit. I was amazed by sort of the lengths the film was trying to go to draw how much in awe everybody was of the Emperor. They give him like this noble music and everybody gets sort of like that Spielberg look, you know, that look that the guy at the keyboard had. in Close Encounters when the mothership landed. You remember that look?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
they,
look, I
they
mean,
they all had that look.
I mean, it could be a combination of things, okay? I mean, it could be that the characters are in awe of the Emperor. Could be that the actors are in awe of Christopher Plummer. Oh, my God. We're on the same set as Christopher Plummer?
A real actor.
Or, don't forget, part of the time that Christopher Plummer's on screen, he's there, like, as a hologram. So he just filmed it, you know, in a studio somewhere. And they all just had to look, you know, with big eyes at this empty space mm-hmm. and go, look, you know, look awesome. Look, just go stare at this space, you know, is this happening? As though, actually, though, I had a weird note on that. I said, when he first talks to them, it's the holographic image of Christopher Plummer. He warns them about the evil count in a very sexy and powerful way. And then I wrote, Acton looks bored. Stella looks sultry.
Christopher Plummer is clearly in awe of himself. When you look at his delivery. I mean, it's that very stoned, metaphysical. The universe is large, and we are but a part. I mean, it's that whole. Clearly, the director told him, you know, be intense. And he is intense.
I wasn't sure if you meant stony or stoned.
Stoned.
But after hearing that impression, I understand you did mean stoned.
Once again, it's the British philosophy of you pay me the money, I'll read the lines. And this is actually very much the reverse of the anecdote about George Lucas and Harrison Ford. In this particular case, they couldn't write this shit, but he was going to read it anyway.
Wow, man, did you ever really look at your universe?
He does have the single best line in the entire film.
Which is
his command when things are going bad to the Imperial battleship. Imperial battleship, halt the flow of time. Nice. Neat trick if you can get it. Wow, wish I had that.
Yeah, and to be fair, it's really pause the flow of time.
It's only 3 minutes, yeah.
It's for 3 minutes. But I'm like, gee, talk about a deus ex machina. You can do that? You know, I think part of the thing is some of the lines in this script are so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And depending on what kind of an actor you are, you know, how you can pull that off. Because a lot of times, I mean, you know, most of Acton's lines are like, fire, fire, or ah, or things like that, you know. But I mean, even we didn't really touch on this too much. But at one point, Stella gets captured by a bunch of hot chicks. So we can all say, yay.
And what's your problem with that? I saw no problem with that, Kevin.
It was 80 young blondes and brunettes, all between the ages of 16 and 19 and a half.
There's some more Monty Python references for you. But I look,
that's Lanthrax.
I do have yay hot chick fight in my notes, okay? So I'm equal opportunity here. But, I mean, she has this – I mean, Corellia, Queen of the Amazons, hot, not the best actress. But she's got a great voice, or the person dubbing her has a great voice. But I mean, even then you get to say things like, put her into the mind probe. You're like, wah. So, I mean, you're just saying these overly dramatic things. And yeah, I mean, you know, how do you pull it off? I mean, if you are Christopher Plummer, you can pull off, you know, whatever, you know, reading the phone book, and you can make it sound cool and dramatic. But yeah, I mean, halt the flow of time. You go, boy.
This is the other thing about Christopher Plummer. Now, I don't know whether this was in his contract, but he is the one who gets to say the title of the film during the film.
Ah, there is that.
You know, they start. And, you know, why is it, you know, there are some cases, it isn't a general case where it's not a good idea to put the title in the film, you know, because, you know, you can think of things like Six Degrees of Separation or Goldfinger or anything like that. And it's fine there. In this particular case, it's like, we have title.
Yeah.
It's a spoiler, too. tells you what happens.
Yeah, that's true.
There will be a star crash happening at some point here. But look, I'm sure they wanted a title. that sounded a little like Star Wars, you know, so they wanted to sort of subliminally, you know, start getting us, you know, ready for it. And then, you know, yeah, he gets to say, you know, Stargrash, he gets to say halt the flow of time. There's all this, you know, super duper dramatic stuff. But I mean, look, there's super duper dramatic stuff. But then in the midst of this big sweeping story, some of the stupidest stuff happens. And I mean, can we start talking about the science and the physics of that closing battles?
Oh yeah, sure, go ahead.
Because I mean, first off, in terms of unbelievability, many things happen here. At one point, and I think I got it down to 1 hour 16 minutes in, there is a string holding up the ship that's sweeping past the camera. So you got to watch it and pause it, but you'll see it. A ship kind of comes in diagonally, it goes whoosh, and you frigging see the string, and you're like, oh my god, did I just see this? My favorite stupid science of this film, and there's a lot of stupid science in this film, but my favorite is in my notes I said, now hang on, now the movie is starting to become unbelievable. Because I have to draw my line in the sand somewhere. Okay. So
you were okay with it up to that point.
I was fine up until that point. So these torpedo things break through the windows of the spaceship. And everyone on board doesn't get sucked out of the broken window from the change in air pressure. I mean, I am no physics major, but I saw Outland, for God's sake. I understand how this works. You're not even supposed to fire a gun. And torpedo after torpedo, filled with guys with annoying laser cannons, all come bursting out. Nothing happens. Nobody gets sucked out the window. I was like, did you open a science book at all?
Well, that's because it does. That will not happen after sundown.
Yeah, and also we were talking at the beginning about the models and how the models just looked really cheap and really plastic and like nobody even bothered to paint them. Right. But then towards the end of the film, you get to the floating city. And the floating city looks like it was made by a kid with a couple of model kits and some red and blue spray paint.
Hot glue gun can do anything. Sorry, Kevin.
I'm sorry. Yeah, with a hot glue gun, you can do anything with Dan. Is this the one that looks like a hand? One of the battle stations looks like a hand.
Ship we were talking about. What exactly is the point with that? You know, and it doesn't even look convincing. I'm going, you know, it's flexing up. Why is it flexing? Yeah. Why are the things going down like that? It doesn't look good. You know, and you know, I was sort of thinking, well, is it supposed to be a hand? I wasn't sure about that. My thought was, you know, like I was talking about the beginning of taking the synopsis and passing it through different languages. My feeling was sort of like that they took the description of an X-wing fighter and passed it through several different translations, and that's what they gave the guy to make the model, you know. So that's what an X-Wing fighter looks like after a game of telephone.
I mean, look, there is no reason to make your spaceship look like a giant claw unless you just go, ooh, that'll be scary and intimidating. But look, I mean, you know, just the bad guys' outfits are ridiculous. Their guns are stylish but stupid. You know, you see strings holding up ships. You see, you know, the laws of physics breaking right and left. People are making references to the Doom Machine and a fourth dimensional attack. And, you know, and one of my favorite lines, you know, talk about science lingo. We're going to sweep through the heart of the stars. All right.
Okay. Sure.
And by the way,
whatever.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, so the Emperor shows up and goes, we're going to halt the flow of time because, you know, because he can. And then they do this 3-minute thing. And then they like cut to them up waiting for the stuff to explode because now he has he got them the extra 3 minutes. So they were able to get away. In between the time when he said, halt the flow of time. And the time when then they all, like, you know, run off and then meet again on the bridge, Stella's wearing a different outfit. Stella used the extra 3 minutes to change into another sexy outfit?
Costume change. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, use exactly. That extra time wisely.
You know, she lives life like Liza Minnelli.
Wow. So,
you know, so by the way, just one further thing about the models. You know, we've been sort of referencing this, and just so that I can clarify this, one of the standard techniques before they had before they went to CG generated models was when you were doing physical models, you would take pieces out of actual model kits and paste them on the model to add detail to the model. One of these models is so bad that they didn't even bother to detach the pieces from the plastic frames.
Oh my God.
Before they put it on the model, they just slapped the entire frame onto the, that'll be good. It's like, you know, if you were supposed to hang a door, and you know, instead of measuring and, you know, putting it up and everything, you just lean it in the door frame and say, yeah, that'll work.
You know, are you saying, Dan, that they just didn't care?
I guess so.
Da, 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 yes. Da, da, da.
Star Wars. Okay.
Did the music, by the way, one more note about the music. Did the music remind anybody of like a live action 1970s Filmation series? Texas or Shazam?
Well, it was sort of knockoff-y in that way. I think actually, let me just check something here because
it sounds a little
John Barry. John Barry actually did the music.
Yeah.
For this. That's sad. Talk about Goldfinger.
It also says, I'm not going to say ripoff, I'm going to say slightly evocative of the original Star Wars music.
Yeah. Yeah, very clearly. Very clearly. Is there anything else we want to talk about with this? Have we gone through Star Crash? Have we crashed through Star Crash sufficiently?
I think we need to say what we learned, and I think we need to start drinking.
Yeah, I think so, too. So let's move on to that. Let's impart to the audience what we learned from this movie, and we'll go around. Andrea, you start. What did you learn from Star Crash?
Okay. The first thing I learned from this movie is lava lamps, smoke, and baby spotlights are terrifying when used in combination.
Kevin?
I learned that the best way to move through space is to swim. As Stella Starr does herself, swim to space.
I learned that Marie Curie died of beach balls.
Ouch. The next thing I learned, and I have you know, I wrote this several days ago before we started having this conversation and everybody jumped on my line. You know the tagline, in space, no one can hear you scream? Well, whoever wrote that was dead wrong, because space is a very noisy place indeed.
Kevin?
No more.
Oh, no more? Okay. Andrea, you and me. I learned that prison uniforms require female convicts to get a Brazilian.
Oh, jeez.
Thank you, Dan. Okay. Radium can be easily transported when in the form of giant ping pong balls.
A declarative sentence is a lot more entertaining when you append it with, for a robot, as in, these apricots are really tasty, for a robot. The metamorphosis of caterpillar into a butterfly is truly one of nature's great wonders. For a robot. Or a cheap jack knockoff of Star Wars with bad acting, an incomprehensible plotline, and awful special effects had better at least offer up some memorable catchphrase that people could cite and maybe turn into some kind of game. For a robot.
Well, I learned one final thing from this movie, which ties in to yours, your topic. In the future, robots will have voice chips that will make them talk like good old boys.
And my final lesson is planets are neither round nor flat, but squiggles. Okay, and let's go to the Star Crash drinking game. So, Andrea, start us off again.
Okay. You should take a drink every time Acton yells, when speaking in a normal tone of voice, would have been perfectly fine.
Kevin?
Take a drink every time somebody sees or hears something they should not be able to see or hear, because one party is in a spaceship and the other party isn't, and there's no visible communications device.
Every time you see something on a spaceship that's totally impractical, take a drink.
Take a drink every time Stella is amazed, surprised, or confused about something.
This might be related. Take a drink every time you see a belly button.
Every time the robot that doesn't look like a robot reminds people that he's a robot, take a drink.
Oh, my God. Well, here's another doozy. Take a drink every time Stella's hair looks beautiful.
Take a drink every time you have to fight the urge to say, Nanu, Nanu.
Every time someone is ecstatically happy for odd reasons, take a drink.
Take a drink every time you see a guy wearing eyeliner.
Take a drink every time there's a science fiction writer reference. I got two. There might be more, maybe in a different dub.
Aha.
Every time a special effect looks like it was made by pointing a camera at a lava lamp, cast a vote for the decriminalization of marijuana.
All right, I have one more. Take a drink every time Christopher Plummer looks like he's thinking that he should be in a better movie.
No, I'm out.
Okay, and my final is, every time the film pays tribute to Ray Harryhausen, pray that Ray Harryhausen never saw this film.
Aww.
And that'll be it for Star Crisis. By the way, you know, the opening that I did, I actually did that process of taking a synopsis of Star Wars and putting it through the translation. You wanted to hear what I came up with?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's what I put in first, okay? And granted, it's not immaculately grammatic, but it's close enough. It gets the idea across. Here's what I wrote. Rebel forces have stolen the plans for the Empire's newest weapon, an armed battle station called the Death Star, capable of destroying entire planets. It's up to Luke Skywalker to join forces with Obi-Wan Kenobi and the space pirates Han Solo and Chewbacca in order to rescue Princess Leia from the clutches of the Sith Lord Darth Vader and get the plans to the Rebel base so that the Rebels can find the Death Star's one weakness and launch an attack against the station. Okay, that's what I put in. And then I put it through. It was French to Norwegian to German to Italian, wow, and then back to English. Okay, here's what came out. The Rebels stole the plans to the Empire's new weapon called Station Army Fight. The Death Star, destroying whole planets, Solo and Chewbacca, Princess Leia is Luke Skywalker to Obi-Wan Kenobi and the space pirates, Han from the clutches of the Sith Lord Darth Vader, and a few Rebel base plans to save. So the Rebels launch a Star's weakness of the dead to find an attack and position on the position.
It's the Norwegian that screwed you up.
Yeah, I think so.
The Norwegian really messed around with the positions of verbs and stuff like that.
Damn Scandies. So that's it for Star Crash. So, Andrea, next month is your turn. What are you going to pick for us?
Next month, we will be watching Mars Needs Women.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
From 1967, starring teen heartthrob Tommy Kirk and sexy bad girl herself, Yvonne Craig.
Classic trailer, I will tell you that. If you've never seen it.
I have to see the trailer. I've seen the movie a couple of times. I have never actually seen the trailer.
I've never seen the movie. Kevin, have you?
I have heard of it all my life. It's been something that's been whispered about and spoken of in hushed tones as one of the best. So I'm really looking forward to this. This is excellent.
It is very doofy, and I identify Tommy Kirk as a teen heartthrob because apparently he was, but in this movie, I do not see 1 ounce of charisma coming from that person.
No throbs, huh?
No. However, Yvonne Craig is still sexy, so there's that.
Okay, and before we get out of here, Andrea, do you want to bring people up to date on what's going on at BeABetterBookTalker.com?
Sure. Swing by BeABetterBookTalker.com. It's a website. It's a podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes. The episode that's up right now is about memoirs and autobiographies for teenagers. But coming up soon are going to be a couple more book talks, which I have not planned yet, so I can't tell you what they're going to be. Plus, I will also be appearing periodically on Cine Fantastique, so tune in. I'll be discussing some movies over there, too.
Yeah, we're going to be having you back.
Yay!
Kevin, what's going on with you?
You can always go to my blog at kevinlauderdale.livejournal.com. And once a month, I'm on the Chronic Rift Network with my podcast, It Has Come to My Attention. And you can subscribe on iTunes or go to chronicrift.com and download that. It's about a 10-minute-long podcast about pop culture items, usually genre-related, that have come to my attention, and I'm drawing them to your attention.
Sounds swell. And let me just point out that you can find us in whole bunches of places, including MightyMoviePodcast.com and the Huffington Post and all of that. But if you want to just get the pure, unalloyed delight of the Temple of Bad podcast, you can go to templeofbad.com.
Yay!
That's our website. And so that'll be it for the show. Andrea Lipinski, thank you for joining us.
Thank you again.
Kevin Lauderdale, thank you as well.
Stella! Stella!
I don't know how we missed that through the entire show, but
what in the universe is wrong with you two?
In any case, I'm Dan Persons. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And remember, may a bad film be the worst thing to happen to you. We've got forsaken. We've got forsaken. God was sleeping. I wonder if God was sleeping.